Chapter 19. Lips for a long time. The mules trotted slowly away from the wharf between the extended hands of the beggars, who for that day seemed to have abandoned in a body the portals of churches. Charles Gould sat on the back seat and looked away upon the plain. A multitude of booths made of green boughs, of rushes, of odd pieces of plank eked out with bits of canvas had been erected all over it for the sale of canna, of dulces, of fruit, of cigars. Over little heaps of glowing charcoal Indian women, squatting on mats, cooked food in black earthen pots, and boiled the water for the mate gourds, which they offered in soft, caressing voices to the country people. A racecourse had been staked out for the vaqueros, and away to the left, from where the crowd was massed thickly about a huge temporary erection, like a circus tent of wood with a conical grass roof, came the resonant twanging of harp strings, the sharp ping of guitars, with the grave drumming throb of an Indian gombo pulsating steadily through the shrill choruses of the dancers. Charles Gould said presently, "All this piece of land belongs now to the railway company. There will be no more popular feasts held here." Mrs. Gould was rather sorry to think so. She took this opportunity to mention how as he had just obtained from Sir John the promise that the house occupied by Giorgio Viola should not be interfered with. She declared she could never understand why the survey engineers ever talked of demolishing that old building. It was not in the way of the projected harbor branch of the line in the least. She stopped the carriage before the door, to reassure at once the old Janice, who came out bareheaded and stood by the carriage step. She talked to him in Italian, of course, and he thanked her with calm dignity. An old Garibaldino was grateful to her from the bottom of his heart for keeping the roof over the heads of his wife and children. He was too old to wander anymore. "And is it forever, Signora?" he asked. "For as long as you like." "Bean. Then the place must be named. It was not worthwhile before." He smiled ruggedly, with a running together of wrinkles at the corners of his eyes. I shall set about the painting of the name tomorrow." "And what is it going to be, Giorgio?" "Albergo d'Italia Una," said the old Garibaldino, looking away for a moment. "M more in memory of those who have died," he added, "than for the country stolen from us soldiers of liberty by the craft of that accursed Piedmontese race of kings and ministers." Mrs. Gould smiled slightly, and, bending over a little, began to inquire about his wife and children. He had sent them into town on that day. The padrona was better in health, many thanks to the signora for inquiring. People were passing in twos and threes, in whole parties of men and women attended by trotting children. A horseman mounted on a silver gray mare drew rein quietly in the shade of the house, after taking off his hat to the party in the carriage, who returned smiles and familiar nods. Old Viola, evidently very pleased with the news he had just heard, interrupted himself for a moment to tell him rapidly that the house was secured, by the kindness of the English signora, for as long as he liked to keep it. The other listened attentively, but made no response. When the carriage moved on, he took off his hat again, a gray sombrero with a silver cord and tassels. The bright colors of a Mexican serape twisted on the cantle, the enormous silver buttons on the embroidered leather jacket, the row of tiny silver buttons down the seam of the trousers, the snowy linen, a silk sash with embroidered ends, the silver plates on headstall and saddle, proclaimed the unapproachable style of the famous Capitas de Cargadores, a Mediterranean sailor got up with more finished splendor than any well-to-do young ranchero of the Campo had ever displayed on a high holiday. "It is a great thing for me," murmured old Giorgio, still thinking of the house, for now he had grown weary of change. "The signora just said a word to the Englishman." "The old Englishman who has enough money to pay for a railway? He is going off in an hour," remarked Nostromo, carelessly. "Un viaggio, then. I've guarded his bones all the way from the Entrada Pass down to the plain and into Sulaco, as though he had been my own father." Old Giorgio only moved his head sideways absently. Nostromo pointed after the Gould's carriage, nearing the grass-grown gate in the old town wall that was like a wall of matted jungle. And I have sat alone at night with my revolver in the company's warehouse time, and again by the side of that other Englishman's heap of silver, guarding it as though it had been my own. Viola seemed lost in thought. It is a great thing for me, he repeated again, as if to himself. It is, agreed the magnificent capitalist cargadors, calmly. Listen, Vecchio, go in and bring me out a cigar, but don't look for it in my room. There's nothing there. Viola stepped into the cafe, and came out directly, still absorbed in his idea, and tendered him a cigar, mumbling thoughtfully in his mustache, children growing up and girls too. Girls. He sighed and fell silent. What, only one? Remarked Nostromo, looking down with a sort of comic inquisitiveness at the unconscious old man. And no matter, he added, with lofty negligence. One is enough till another is wanted. He lit it, and let the match drop from his passive fingers. Giorgio Viola looked up, and said abruptly, My son would have been just such a fine young man as you, Gian Battista, if he had lived. What? Your son? But you are right, Padron. If he had been like me, he would have been a man. He turned his horse slowly, and paced on between the booths. Checking the mare almost to a standstill now, and then for children, for the groups of people from the distant campo, who stared after him with admiration. The company's lightermen saluted him from afar, and the greatly envied capitalist cargadors advanced, amongst murmurs of recognition and obsequious greetings, towards the huge circus-like erection. The throng thickened. The guitars tinkled louder. Other horsemen sat motionless, smoking calmly above the heads of the crowd. It eddied and pushed before the doors of the high-roofed building, whence issued a shuffle and thumping of feet in time to the dance music vibrating and shrieking with a racking rhythm, overhung by the tremendous, sustained, hollow roar of the gombo. The barbarous and imposing noise of the big drum, that can madden a crowd, and that even Europeans cannot hear without a strange emotion, seemed to draw Nostromo onto its source, while a man, wrapped up in a faded, torn poncho, walked by his stirrup, and, buffeted right and left, begged his worship insistently for employment on the wharf. He whined, offering the senior capitas half his daily pay for the privilege of being admitted to the swaggering fraternity of cargadors. The other half would be enough for him, he protested. But Captain Mitchell's right-hand man, valuable for our work, a perfectly incorruptible fellow, after looking down critically at the ragged mozo, shook his head without a word in the uproar going on around. The man fell back. And a little further on Nostromo, had to pull up. From the doors of the dance hall men and women emerged tottering, streaming with sweat, trembling in every limb, too lean, panting, with staring eyes and parted lips, against the wall of the structure, where the harps and guitars played on with mad speed in an incessant roll of thunder. Hundreds of hands clapped in there. Voices shrieked, and then all at once would sink low, chanting in unison the refrain of a love song, with a dying fall. A red flower, flung with a good aim from somewhere in the crowd, struck the resplendent capitas on the cheek. He caught it as it fell, neatly, but for some time did not turn his head. When at last he condescended to look round, the throng near him had parted to make way for a pretty Morenita, her hair held up by a small golden comb, who was walking towards him in the open space. Her arms and neck emerged plump and bare from a snowy chemisette. The blue woolen skirt, with all the fullness gathered in front, scanty on the hips and tight across the back, disclosed the provoking action of her walk. She came straight on and laid her hand on the mare's neck with a timid, coquettish look upwards out of the corner of her eyes. Querido, she murmured, caressingly, why do you pretend not to see me when I pass? Because I don't love thee anymore, said Nostromo, deliberately, after a moment of reflective silence. The hand on the mare's neck trembled suddenly. She dropped her head before all the eyes in the white circle formed round the generous, the terrible, the inconstant Capitas de Cargadores, and his Morenita. Nostromo, looking down, saw tears beginning to fall down her face. "Has it come, then, ever beloved of my heart?" she whispered. "Is it true?" "No," said Nostromo, looking away carelessly. "It was a lie. I love thee as much as ever." "Is that true?" she cooed, joyously, her cheeks still wet with tears. "It is true. True on the life?" "As true as that. But thou must not ask me to swear it on the Madonna that stands in thy room." And the Capitas laughed a little in response to the grins of the crowd. She pouted very pretty, a little uneasy. "No, I will not ask for that. I can see love in your eyes." She laid her hand on his knee. "Why are you trembling like this?" "From love," she continued, while the cavernous thundering of the gombo went on without a pause. "But if you love her as much as that, you must give your Paquita a gold-mounted rosary of beads for the neck of her Madonna." "No," said Nostromo, looking into her uplifted, begging eyes, which suddenly turned stony with surprise. "No? Then what else will your worship give me on the day of the fiesta?" she asked, angrily, "so as not to shame me before all these people." "There is no shame for thee in getting nothing from thy lover for once." "True. The shame is your worship's, my poor lovers," she flared up, sarcastically. Laughs were heard at her anger, at her retort. What an audacious spitfire she was. The people aware of this scene were calling out urgently to others in the crowd. The circle round the silver-gray mare narrowed slowly. The girl went off a pace or two, confronting the mocking curiosity of the eyes, then flung back to the stirrup, tiptoeing, her enraged face turned up to Nostromo with a pair of blazing eyes. He bent low to her in the saddle. "Juan," she hissed, "I could stab thee to the heart." The dreaded Capitas de Cargadores, magnificent and carelessly public in his amours, flung his arm round her neck and kissed her spluttering lips. A murmur went round. "A knife," he demanded at large, holding her firmly by the shoulder. 20 blades flashed out together in the circle. A young man in holiday attire, bounding in, thrust one in Nostromo's hand and bounded back into the ranks, very proud of himself. Nostromo had not even looked at him. "Stand on my foot," he commanded the girl, who, suddenly subdued, rose lightly, and when he had her up, encircling her waist, her face near to his, he pressed the knife into her little hand. "No, Morenita. You shall not put me to shame," he said. "You shall have your present, and so that everyone should know who is your lover today, you may cut all the silver buttons off my coat." There were shouts of laughter and applause at this witty freak, while the girl passed the keen blade, and the impassive rider jingled in his palm the increasing hoard of silver buttons. He eased her to the ground with both her hands full. After whispering for a while with a very strenuous face, she walked away, staring haughtily, and vanished into the crowd. The circle had broken up, and the lordly Capitas de Cargadores, the indispensable man, the tried and trusty Nostromo, the Mediterranean sailor come ashore casually, to try his luck in Costaguana, rode slowly towards the harbor. The Juno was just then swinging round, and even as Nostromo reined up again to look on, a flag ran upon the improvised flagstaff erected in an ancient and dismantled little fort at the harbor entrance. Half a battery of field guns had been hurried over there from the Sulaco barracks for the purpose of firing the regulation salutes for the president, dictator, and the war minister. As the mail boat headed through the pass, the badly timed reports announced the end of Don Vincent Ribera's first official visit to Sulaco, and for Captain Mitchell the end of another historic occasion. Next time when the Hope of Honest Men was to come that way, a year and a half later, it was unofficially, over the mountain tracks, fleeing after a defeat on a lame mule, to be only just saved by Nostromo from an ignominious death at the hands of a mob. It was a very different event, of which Captain Mitchell used to say, "It was history, history, sir." And that fellow of mine, Nostromo, you know, was right in it. Absolutely making history, sir. But this event, creditable to Nostromo, was to lead immediately to another, which could not be classed either as history, or as a mistaken Captain Mitchell's phraseology. He had another word for it. Sir, he used to say afterwards, that was no mistake. It was a fatality. A misfortune, pure and simple, sir. And that poor fellow of mine was right in it, right in the middle of it. A fatality, if ever there was one, and to my mind he has never been the same man since. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.